From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch, health, nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware-Peet. Whether in work, in relationships, or in shaping the world around you, understanding people's drives and motivations, even when they themselves are unconscious of them, will give you a leg up as you navigate human behavior. Decoding what makes people tick is not only a fascinating study, but it's useful in developing empathy and also so we don't get possibly overrun or duped by some of those personality types out there. My next guest is a best-selling author and a really interesting person to chat with. I spoke with him last week to discuss his new book, The Laws of Human Nature. Robert Greene, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Well, thank you for having me, Lynn. My pleasure.
So this book is, I'm holding it in my hands. I know it's the culmination of 6 years of work for you. It's maybe a follow-up, but maybe a complement to your previous best-selling book, The 48 Laws of Power. Now it's The Laws of Human Nature. What was the genesis?
Well, I wrote my previous book was called Mastery, and in that book I had a chapter on what I call social intelligence. Generally, the idea is that if you really want to be successful in life, it's not enough to just be technically brilliant at your field. You also have to be able to get along with people, and that's also a skill that you need to master. And it was a chapter that really resonated with readers. They said it really was helpful, but they wanted more information. And so basically, this book is kind of an expansion of that chapter. But even more than that, I've been doing consulting work for 20 years, people in all different businesses. And it's always the same problem. How do I deal with this employee who I can't seem to motivate? Why did I hire this business partner that ends up like taking over my company and is incredibly toxic? Why can't I get along with people? What are they thinking? And I realized this is actually a real, real huge problem in our culture today, that people are in a lot of pain because they don't really understand the psychology and what motivates human behavior. So that was essentially what inspired the writing of this book. I really wanted to help people.
Well, do you feel like in some ways we have devolved from understanding what motivates human behavior? Because we now, as much as we are social creatures, we're social in a much different way now that often precludes our ability to see someone's body language or their response, because we're very often communicating via email or text.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, if you think about the 19th century, you think about like a Jane Austen novel, where people are constantly socializing. They had no internet, they had no television. Their only source of entertainment, their only source of pleasure was with being around other people. So they were continually socializing. And the ability to get along with people is a function of how much and how intensely you interact with people. And now you look at the world today, you know, 200 years later from the time of Jane Austen, and you see people I look at couples in a restaurant. They're not making eye contact. They're both looking at their phones and finding something, and then kind of looking at each other and laughing. So people are not connecting. They're not socializing as much. They're not paying as deep attention to other people. And it's a skill that can erode, you know.
Right.
Anything that we do, like if you wanted to learn how to play a piano, you have to practice. And the more you repeat and the more you do it, the better you get at it. And if you've ever been through a period where you do a lot of socializing, where you're forced to, it's kind of like a muscle that you develop and you get better at it and you get more comfortable. So I think it's a terrible problem today that people are spending far too much time on their phones and in this kind of virtual realm, and they're not interacting enough.
Right. Well, it's funny you bring up the example of Jane Austen, because we have to have these contrived settings now that we, you know, we name them and schedule them, and they're called salons or speakeasies or you know, whatever it is, that we put ourselves in this setting that in the days of Jane Austen that they did every day. And in a way, it creates some naivete, I think, around learning about different types of human behaviors. And, you know, luckily, for example, in my life, I had never I never recognized that I had met a narcissist until, about 10 years ago. And then I learned all about it. Now I see it all around me. And so, you know, and it's interesting, it's your second chapter, the law of narcissism. And so maybe for our listeners, you can just go into that and describe how you explain narcissism.
Well, I want to give it a slightly different angle. My idea is that all of us are narcissists. It is part of human nature. I want to take the guilt out of it. We are all self-absorbed. It just so happens that some people are what I call deep narcissists. Their self-absorption is deeper and is more problematic and more toxic. But essentially, we all have to have a self that we love and that we respect and that validates us. And what I mean by that is we develop this in childhood. And in those moments when people are not paying attention to us, when we're alone, or when we're not getting what we need from other people, we can kind of withdraw into ourselves and find that kind of love and respect and attention from our own self-image. It's very critical development in childhood. And if you don't have it, you have major problems growing up. The problem is that this narcissism gets more and more intense as we get older. And we find that the only things that we're interested in are our own ideas. We want to associate with people who reflect ourselves, who share our own values and ideas. And so we're cutting ourselves off from the great diversity in our culture. We only want to talk to people who kind of reflect what we already think. And when we're in conversation with people, we're not really paying attention to them. We're kind of absorbed in our own thoughts. We're thinking about our own problems. We don't find them as interesting as we find ourselves. So that is what I call the kind of narcissism that we all share. And there's no guilt in that. But the problem is some people are such deep narcissists that they can never get out of themselves. They can never begin to pay attention to other people. Everything has to revolve around them. They constantly need attention from other people to get their validation because they can't get it from themselves. And the problem with the deep narcissist is that they learn in early childhood, since they never developed a self that they can love because of, various reasons. They're always acting out. They always have to be dramatic. They always have to do things that pull people in. And they can be very charming. They can have charisma because they've spent their whole life developing a skill to get people to pay attention to them. But there's nothing behind it. It's very empty. It's not that they're paying attention. They're not trying to get attention because they're interested in you. It's because they have a great hole in themselves and they have to always kind of be the center of things. And they can get involved in them. They can be your boss or they can be your spouse or your partner. And you only discover a year later that that's how they operate. And it's very painful because it's hard to disentangle yourself from people like that. And they've got a kind of a grip on your emotions. So I'm trying to take away the guilt. I'm trying to say we all share in this quality. I'm also trying to help you recognize those deep narcissists in life who, before you get involved with them.
And so I was wondering what the next step is before you get involved with them. I mean, do we avoid narcissists entirely, or is there hope? Because it is a very sad condition, isn't it? And we talk so much about empathy, that we can learn and teach empathy in our culture. Is there hope for narcissists?
Well, it depends on how deep it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, I make the point that some people can get out of their narcissism through their work. They pour a lot of their energy, like a lot of great CEOs, like an Elon Musk or a Steve Jobs. They're definitely narcissists, but they managed to pour a lot of productive energy into their work. And to that extent, they can function and they can be, you know, decent people. But generally, it's very hard for such people to have self-awareness because they're very touchy. They have what we call narcissistic rage because they don't have a self that anchors them that they can love. If you try and tell them something is wrong, they get extremely defensive and they go into rage and they blame you and they position themselves continually as the victim. So they can't learn from their mistakes because they don't want to learn. They want to always be thinking that it's the other person's fault. So for most deep narcissists, it's very difficult and very painful because it's hard to get them to correct themselves, to listen to you. And so the best thing, if it's a truly, truly toxic person, is to not get involved in the first place, to recognize them in advance. And if you have the misfortune of having them as a business partner or as an intimate partner, it's not so simple. And, you know, I don't have an easy answer for that. But I do know the incredible pain and damage a relationship with them can cause. And I think the best offense is defense is to recognize them before you get involved. And it's not difficult. There are so many signs that give off in advance. It's just that you're not paying attention.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Greene. He's written The Laws of Human Nature. It's a follow-up, shall we say, to The 48 Laws of Power, which was a New York Times bestseller. Robert, I'm wondering if we are someone who is always honest to a fault, if we are someone who maybe lacks confidence and will not make any declaration about any one thing unless we know absolutely 100% of the facts. It's hard for us to realize that there are a lot of people out there that don't operate by that, that are very confident and will just inspire people to trust them, even though they may be, you know, delivering half of the facts and half of it is fabricated.
Right.
How do we recognize that sort of behavior if we're sort of naive to it?
Well, you have to, the book is trying to shed you of your naivete.
Right.
I mean, I had that problem myself when I was in my 20s and 30s in the work world, and it caused me a lot of pain and I made a lot of mistakes. I want you to understand that if there are people out there who are difficult to deal with, who are manipulative, who are power hungry, and it only can be 1 in 10 in your office, but that 1 in 10 can cause a lot of problems. And you're inevitably going to cross their path. They're out there. So I want you to be aware and to understand something. People who are like that, who are manipulative, who are power hungry, who are passive aggressive, who are envious, on and on, they don't announce themselves. They don't walk around wearing a sign saying, I'm a toxic person. They've spent their life developing strategies to disguise it so that they draw you in, so that they can function in society without, you know, without repelling people. So they've learned all kinds of masks that they wear. So for instance, someone who's a very envious type, and envy is something that's extremely prevalent in our culture and is a very dangerous emotion. Someone who's a toxic, envious person, a strategy they often use is they befriend you. They're extremely friendly with you when they first meet them. They're so friendly that you're shocked. Wow, this is great. I've never had somebody who's so into me in so little time. But you don't realize until later when they like gained all this information about you and they've created a kind of an emotional bond and they sabotage you in some way that's kind of dark and nasty. Then you realize, wow, what's going on? And you may even blame yourself for what happened. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of naivete that can be dangerous. So you have to understand that people like that don't announce themselves. They wear disguises. And my book, a lot of the book, is talking about how to rip that mask away, how to identify these people, just like we talk about with the narcissist, before you get involved with them.
Yeah, you know, Walter Cronkite, the days of Walter Cronkite are over,
right?
And we find that even our older generation, that's what they knew, and they knew when news was presented to them, it was accurate, it was well-researched, it was true. And now we have these pundits who are, in essence, befriending us. How does your book, how would your book help us to, as you say, rip the mask off people who seem like they're telling the truth, but they're delivering a platform that they're very effective in convincing us of?
Well, chapter number one in the book, you mentioned chapter two on Narsim, chapter number one is about irrationality. And I'm basically trying to make the point that we humans are not rational creatures. We're emotional creatures. So much of what we think and respond comes from our emotions that are much more powerful than our thinking. And so I want you to be aware of that fact. And when you're aware of that fact, you understand that a lot of people in business, a lot of people who are these pundits, a lot of people who are trying to sell you something, are basically playing on your emotion. They don't have your best interests in heart. They're trying to sell something. And in selling something, they have to, in some ways, kind of emphasize their, you know, kind of hide the flaws in what they're selling, et cetera. So I want you to realize when you feel that somebody is playing on your emotions, that they're saying something to heat you up, when they're saying something to kind of play to your dark side and make you all kind of tribal and angry and us versus them, et cetera, that person is deceiving you. And I'm trying to make the point that if someone is rational, they present facts, they try and convince you, they're not dogmatic, they understand that truth has nuances to it, and they're calm, and they even maybe present both sides, and they're reasonable. But how rarely is we ever find that on people in television or in the media? Because they're trying to rile you up, they're trying to play continually to your emotions, which is the weak and vulnerable side of human nature. So I want to arm you with some basic knowledge. When people are playing to your emotions, they are deceiving you. And when they appear to be full of so much conviction, I'm just possessed of the truth. I have to convince you of this. This is the way it is. You better be damn sure that they are playing a game, that they are deceiving you, that they are insecure themselves, and they have to talk so loud and yell in order to kind of make their point instead of appeal to reason. So that's the weapon I give you in my book to help you in that sense.
It's a great weapon. And in your book, you bring up countless examples of people throughout history, people who we know from history, from Stalin to Queen Elizabeth to even Martin Luther King. Can you bring up an example of something that's accessible to us that we know of a person in popular culture that we can either read for being honest, for being deceptive, for being manipulative? And talk to us about how we might rip off the layers.
Well, that's a tricky question. I mean, I have a chapter in the book about grandiosity, about the dangers of success and how it can easily go to your head and you can believe that yes, anything you do is you've got the golden touch, you can't make any mistakes. And I find that's a common problem that CEOs have. I worked on the board of directors of the company American Apparel, where the CEO had that. And I see that quality in people a bit like Elon Musk. Mm-hmm. Now, this man is very, very brilliant, no doubt. You know, he was involved with PayPal, et cetera. He does, to some degree, have a kind of a golden touch, and he is sort of a visionary. But you can recognize very many signs of grandiosity in this person, in the fact that he believes that anything he does, no matter what venture, is going to succeed because he's just absolutely brilliant. And he makes terrible mistakes. He made mistakes publicly when he insulted the Thai people and thought that he alone was going to rescue those children from the cave by inventing some kind of submarine. He's continually insulting or putting off people on Wall Street. He has a publicly traded company. He tweets things that he shouldn't tweet, not realizing that he has a board of directors, that he has to be careful what he says. He thinks that he can say or do or get away with anything because he has this golden touch, and success is like a halo that he wears. And no matter what he does, you know, he's bound to succeed. And I don't want to get too political.
Right.
Here, but you could say something similar about our president in a way.
Mm-hmm.
At that moment where he made the phone call to the Ukraine, and you can argue both sides of the case, I'm not going to argue it here, but he had just come fresh off the Mueller report and being exonerated on that, or apparently exonerated. And he probably believed in his mind, wow, I can do anything. Republicans have my back. I can say or do anything I want. And it's gonna work. And he went too far. probably in that phone call, and we'll have to see how that plays out. But you'll notice in a lot of people in the public eye really suffer from that. Their success goes to their head. They become arrogant. They think that anything they do is just brilliant, and then they can transfer their skills to whatever they want to, and they make mistakes. It's what often happens to musicians who have a great first album, and this happened a lot in the rap world. And they think, "Wow, I'm a genius. I'm Mozart. I'm Beethoven, etc." And the second album is a total flop because they're not paying attention anymore to their audience. They're not thinking. They're just living off their success, and they've become grandiose. So that's one example I would give in popular culture.
Yeah, that's a great example. It's funny that when we're duped, or when we are influenced by this sort of behavior, it's as though it trumps, sorry to use that word, it trumps our own intuition and our own gut feeling to the extent that we don't trust ourselves about our own judgment anymore. And this is what it seems to me that your book is really trying to do, is to get us to develop our gut instinct about human behavior. Would that be an accurate assessment?
Yes, it's both an intuitive feel, because you're right. You don't have time when you're meeting someone for the first time to go through a lot of deep analysis. You have to have a kind of intuitive feel. And a lot of times you notice that people, when you first meet someone, you have a gut reaction that is negative or positive. And you don't pay attention to it because you don't trust things like intuition. Mm-hmm. And then later you realize, wow, that person is toxic. They are passive aggressive. And I kind of knew that, but then I got involved with them.
Yeah.
So to a degree, you're right. You need to trust your instincts. But you also need to be armed with a lot of knowledge, which I'm trying to provide to you, so that when you're in a social situation, you don't have to think. You don't have to be sitting there reading my book while you're talking to someone. obviously, that's not going to work. But you have this knowledge and you go, oh, I recognize from the book, I see what's going on here. This person has a dark side, and that dark side is kind of leaking out right now. Or yes, this is a passive aggressor. You don't have to think, you can feel it and you sense it, and then you can respond in a certain way. So yeah, I agree with your assessment.
So we've talked about the law of grandiosity, the law of narcissism, some of my other favorites, and you have many chapters on the laws. And I like the laws of envy, the law of short-sightedness, the law of self-sabotage. What are some of your favorite chapters that you've written in this book?
Well, I like the chapter on the shadow, on the dark side in human nature, because mm-hmm. I think it's a real issue in our culture. If you look at all of our movies and our popular entertainment, they all revolve around kind of dark themes. Movies like The Joker, for instance, which just recently came out. People are obsessed with Machiavellian, scheming, evil characters.
Yeah.
And I maintain it's because we live in a culture that only promotes virtue, that you have to always kind of present this virtuous side, that you have to be a paragon of saintliness, that you're always supporting the best causes, and that by nature we all have a dark side. And we're repressing it constantly so that we can appear to be that paragon of virtue that is so prized in our culture. And because of that repression, we're fascinated by this other shadow side of human behavior that we've all are striving to repress. And so we secretly want to go see movies like The Joker, et cetera, to kind of revel in that side that we're not able to bring out in ourselves. And in the chapter I talk about how you need to bring out your own dark side, how you need to embrace it, how you need to see it, how you need to make it a productive part of your personality instead of continually repressing it. So that's one of my favorite chapters, I suppose. I don't know what that says about me, but
repressing that dark side. Well, the book is The Laws of Human Nature. My guest is Robert Greene. And Robert, I thank you so much for joining me today. And I just wanted to mention, when I picked up your book, I first thought that it was like the DSM for mental disorders, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, but with the human behaviors instead. Yeah. So it's like a reference book in a way. Would you say?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, you don't have to read. It's not designed to read cover to cover.
Right.
You know, you can kind of pick and choose the different chapters that are right and really important to your life if you're dealing with a narcissist or you're dealing with someone who's very passive aggressive. So, yeah, it is a kind of a manual that way. I think that is a good way of looking at it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for writing it, and thanks for being my guest today.
Well, thank you so much, Lynn. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life. If you missed part of the show or want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab. We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows. Wherever you find your podcasts, you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name. So look for KPCW The Mountain Life and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.